took alarm at the gesture and skittered back, throwing the rat at Bonnet. It hit him in the knee, surprising him and making him hesitate for the split second necessary for Germaine to vanish into the myrtles. I could hear his feet chuffing the sand as he ran, and hoped he knew where Massali was. The last thing we needed was for him to lose himself. Well, possibly not the very last thing, I amended. The very last thing we needed was for Stephen Bonnet to lay eyes on Jemmy, which he promptly did, when the latter wandered out of the bushes an instant later, his short gown smeared with mud, more mud oozing through the fingers of his clenched fists. There was no sun, but Jemmy's hair seemed to blaze with the brilliance of a striking match. Paralysis disappearing in a heartbeat, I grabbed him up and backed away several steps, knocking over the half-filled bucket of myrtle berries. Bonnet's eyes were the pale green of a cat's, and they brightened now with the intentness of a cat that spots a creeping mouse. "And who will this sweet Manon be?" he asked, taking a step toward me. "My son," I said instantly, and pulled Jem tight against my shoulder, ignoring his struggles. With the natural perversity of small children, he seemed to be fascinated by Bonnet's Irish lilt, and kept turning his head to stare at the stranger. "Favours his father, I see." Drops of sweat glistened in the heavy blonde brows. He smoothed first one, then the other, with the tip of his finger, so the sweat ran in trickles down the sides of his face, but the pale green eyes never wavered in their regard. "As does his sister. And is your lovely daughter any place nearby, dear one? I should enjoy to renew our acquaintance. Such a charming girl, Brianna," he smiled. "No doubt you would," I said, making no particular effort to disguise the edge in my voice. "No, she isn't. She's at home, with her husband." I leaned heavily on the word husband, hoping that Brianna was near enough to hear me and take warning. But he paid it no mind. "At home now." "And where do you call home then, Mum?" He took off the hat and wiped his face with his sleeve. "Oh, in the back country. A homestead." I waved vaguely in the direction I thought, roughly west. What was this, social conversation? And yet the choices seemed distinctly limited. I could turn and flee, at which point he would catch me handily, burdened as I was with Jemmy. Or I could stand here until he revealed what he wanted. I didn't think he was out for a picnic among the myrtles.
"A homestead," he repeated, a muscle twitching in his cheek.
"What business brings you so far from home, and might I ask?"
"You might not," I said.
"Or rather, you might ask my husband. He'll be along shortly."
I took another step backward as I said this, and he took a step toward me at the same time. A flicker of panic must have crossed my face, for he looked amused and took another step.
"Oh, I doubt that, Mrs. Fraser, dear. For you see, the man's dead by now."
I squeezed Jemmy so hard that he let out a strangled squawk. "What do you mean?" I demanded hoarsely. The blood was draining from my head, coagulating in an icy ball round my heart.
"Well, do you see, it was a bargain," he said, the look of amusement growing. "A division of duties, you might say. My friend Lilywhite and the good sheriff were to attend to Mr. Fraser and Mr. Mackenzie, and Lieutenant Wolfe was to manage Mrs. Cameron's end of the business. That left me with the pleasant task of making myself reacquainted with my son and his mother."
His eyes sharpened, focusing on Jemmy. "I don't know what you're talking about," I said through stiff lips, taking a better grip on Jemmy, who was watching Bonnet, owl-eyed. He gave a short laugh at that.
"Sure, and you're no hand at lying, ma'am. You forgive the observation. You'd never make a card player. You know well enough what I mean. You saw me there, at River Run, though I confess as how I should be obliged to hear exactly what you and Mr. Fraser was engaged in, a butchering that negro woman that Wolf killed. I did hear as how the picture of a murderer shows in the victim's eyes, but you didn't seem to be looking at her eyes from what I could see. Was it magic of a sort you were after doing?"
"Wolf! It was him, then!" Just at that moment I didn't really care whether Lieutenant Wolfe had murdered scores of women, but I was willing to engage in any line of conversation that offered the possibility of distracting him.
"Aye, he's a bungler, Wolfe," he said dispassionately. "But 'twas him that found out about the gold to begin with, so he claimed a part in the doings."
How far away were Massali and Brianna? Had Germaine found them? I could hear nothing over the whine of insects and the distant wash of surf. Surely they must hear us talking, though.
"Gold?" I said, raising my voice a little. "Whatever do you mean, gold? There isn't any gold at River Run. Jocasta Cameron told you as much."
He puffed air through his lips in genial disbelief.
"I will say as Mrs. Cameron is a better liar than yourself, dear one, but sure I didn't believe her either. The doctor saw the gold, see?"
"What doctor?" A baby's high-pitched cry came faintly through the bushes.
"Joan." I coughed, hoping to drown it out, and repeated more loudly,
"What doctor do you mean?"
"Rawls, I think was his name, or Rawlings."
Bonnet was frowning slightly, head turned toward the sound.
"I'd not the pleasure of his acquaintance, though. I might be mistaken."
"I'm sorry, I still have no idea what you're talking about." I was trying simultaneously to hold his gaze and to scan the ground nearby for anything that might be used as a weapon. Bonnet had a pistol in his belt and a knife, but showed no disposition to draw either one. Why should he? A woman with an armload of 2-year-old wasn't any sort of threat. One thick blonde brow flicked up, but he seemed in no great hurry, whatever he was about.
"No? Well, 'twas Wolfe, as I was saying. It was a tooth to be drawn or something. He met with this Sawbones in Cross Creek, bought the fellow a drink in reward, and spent the evening inside a wineskin with him in the end. You'll know the lieutenant's weakness for the drink. The doctor was another sort, I hear, and the two of them thick as thieves before the dawn. Rawlins let out that he'd seen a great quantity of gold at River Run, for he'd just come from there, see?"
Rawlins had either passed out or sobered up enough to say no more, but the revelation had been enough to renew the lieutenant's determination to gain the hand and property of Jocasta Cameron.
"The lady would be having none of him, though, and then she ups and declares as she'll be taking the one-armed fella instead. 'Twas a cruel blow to the lieutenant's pride, alas."
He grinned at that, showing a missing molar on one side. Lieutenant Wolfe, furious and baffled, appealed to his particular friend, Randall Lillywhite, for advice.
"Why, that... So that's why he arrested the priest at the gathering? To prevent him marrying Mrs. Cameron to Duncan Innes?"
Bonnet nodded.
"That would be the way of it.
A matter of delay, you might say, so as to be having the opportunity of looking further into the matter."
Said opportunity had occurred at the wedding. As we had theorised, someone, Lieutenant Wolfe, had in fact attempted to drug Duncan Innes with a cup of punch spiked with laudanum. The plan had been to render him insensible and pitch him into the river. During the uproar occasioned by Duncan's disappearance and presumably accidental death, Wolfe would have the chance to search the premises thoroughly for gold and eventually to renew his addresses to Jocasta.
"But the black bitch drank the stuff herself," he said dispassionately. "Didn't die of it, worse luck. But she could have said who gave the cup to her, of course. And so Wolfe slipped round and mixed ground glass into the gruel they were after feeding her."
"What I want to know," I said, "is just how you got involved in this. Why were you there at River Run?"
"And isn't the lieutenant the friend of me bosom these many years past, dear one? He came to me for help in disposing of the one-armed lad, so he could take care to be seen in the midst of the party, enjoying himself in all innocence whilst accident was befalling his rival."
He frowned slightly, tapping a finger on the hilt of his pistol.
"I would have done better to bash the innocent fella on the head and toss him in, once I saw the laudanum had gone astray. Couldn't get at him, though. He spent half the day in the jakes, and someone always in there with him, bad cess to them."
There was nothing on the ground near me that could possibly be used as a weapon. Twigs, leaves, scattered fragments of shell, a dead rat. Well, that had worked for Germaine, but I didn't think Bonnet could be surprised twice in that fashion. Jemmy was losing his fear of the stranger as we talked, and was beginning to squirm to get down. I edged backward a little. Bonnet saw it and smiled. He wasn't bothered. Obviously he didn't think I could escape, and just as obviously he was waiting for something. Of course. He had told me himself. He was waiting for Brianna. I realized belatedly that he had clearly followed us out here from town. He knew that Massali and Brianna were somewhere nearby. Much easier simply to wait until they revealed themselves. My best hope was that someone else would happen along. The weather was muggy and damp, but not raining yet, and this was a well-known spot for picnicking, according to Mrs. Burns. If someone did come along, how could I take advantage of it? I knew that Bonnet wouldn't have the slightest compunction in simply shooting anyone who got in his way. He was boasting about the rest of his bloodthirsty plans.
Mrs. Cameron, Mrs. Innes Shelby now, seemed willing enough to talk when I suggested that her husband might soon be lacking a few of his treasured parts. Though, as it happens, she was lying then too, deceitful old trout. But it came to me, pondering the matter afterward, that she might be more obliging were it matter of her heir.
He nodded toward Jemmy and clicked his tongue at the boy.
So, lad, will we be going to see your great-auntie, then?
Jemmy looked suspiciously at Bonnet, cuddling back against me.
Who's that?
He asked.
Oh, it's a wise child that knows its father, isn't it? I'm your da, lad. Was your mother not after telling you so?
Daddy?
Jemmy looked at Bonnet, then at me.
That's not Daddy.
No, he isn't your daddy, I assured Jemmy, shifting my hold.
My arms were beginning to ache under the strain of holding him.
He's a bad man. We don't like him.
Bonnet laughed.
Is there no shame with you at all, dear one? Of course he's mine. It's your daughter has said so to my face.
Nonsense, I said. I had manoeuvred my way into a narrow gap between two of the evergreen wax myrtle bushes. I tried to distract him, back into conversation, then seize a moment to whirl round, set Jemmy down and urge him to run. With luck, I could block the gap long enough to prevent Bonnet grabbing him before he could get away, if he would run.
Lilywhite, I said, taking hold of the conversation. What do you mean Lilywhite and the sheriff were going to...
to attend to my husband and Mr. Mackenzie? Merely mentioning the possibility made me feel sick. Sweat was running down my sides, but my face felt cold and clammy.
All that? What I said, Mrs. Fraser. Your husband is dead.
He had started looking past me, pale green eyes flicking through the shrubbery. He was clearly expecting Brianna to show up at any moment.
What happened at the wedding showed us clear enough that it wouldn't do to leave Mrs. Cameron with so much protection. No, if we meant to try again, the thing to do was to see that she's no man folks to call upon, either for help or vengeance. So when your husband suggested to Mr. Lyon that he fetch me along to a private meeting, I thought that might be a suitable opportunity to dispose of him and Mr. Mackenzie. Two birds with one whisky keg, as you might be saying. But then I thought best if Lilywhite were the lad to handle that end of things, him and his tame sheriff.
He smiled.
I thought best I'd come to be fetching my son and his mother along, so as not to risk anything going amiss, you see. We'll...
I shifted weight, spun on my heel, and plunked Jemmy on the ground on the far side of the bushes. Run, I said urgently to him. Run, Jem, go! There was a flash of red as he scampered away, whimpering with fear, and then Bonnet crashed into me. He tried to shove me aside, but I was ready for that, and grabbed for the pistol at his belt. He felt me snatch and jerked back, but I had my fingers on the butt. I got it free and flung it behind me as I fell to the ground with him on top of me. He rolled off me and up on his knees, where he froze.
Stay there, or by the Holy Virgin I'll blow your head off.
Gasping from the fall, I sat up slowly to see Massali, pale as a sheet, aiming the ancient flintlock at him over the swell of her belly.
Shoot him, maman!
Germaine was behind her, small face alight with eagerness.
Shoot him like a porcupine!
Joan was somewhere back in the bushes. She began to wail at the sound of her mother's voice, but Massali didn't take her eyes off Bonnet. Christ, had she loaded and primed the gun? I thought she must have. I could smell a whiff of black powder.
Well, now, Bonnet said slowly. I could see his eyes trace the distance between him and Massali, 15 feet or more, too much to reach her with a dive. He put one foot on the ground, beginning to rise. He could reach her in 3 strides. Don't let him stand up! I scrabbled up onto my own feet, shoving at his shoulder. He fell to the side, catching himself on one hand, then heaved back faster than I could have imagined, seizing me round the waist and pulling me back down, this time on top of him. There were screams from behind me, but I had no attention to spare. I stabbed my fingers at his eye, narrowly missing as he jerked me sideways. My nails slid off his cheekbone, raking furrows in his skin. We rolled in a flurry of petticoats and Irish oaths, me grabbing for his privates, him trying at once to throttle me and protect himself. Then he squirmed and flipped over like a fish, and we ended with his arm locked tight around my neck, holding me against his chest. There was a whisper of metal on leather and something cold against my neck. I stopped struggling and took a deep breath. Masali's eyes were the size of saucers, her mouth clamped tight. Her gaze, thank heaven, was still trained on Bonnet, and so was the gun. Masali, I said very calmly, shoot him, right now.
Be putting the gun down, Colleen, Bonnet said with equal calmness, or I'll cut her throat on the count of 3.
1.
Shoot him, I said with all my force and took my last deep gulp of air.
2. Wait.
The pressure of the blade across my throat lessened, and I felt the sting of blood as I took a breath that I hadn't expected to be given. I hadn't time to enjoy the sensation, though. Brianna stood amid the myrtles, Jemmy clinging to her skirts.
Let her go, she said.
Massali had been holding her breath. She let it out with a gasp and sucked air deep.
He isn't about to let me go, and it doesn't matter, I said firmly to them both. Massali, shoot him, now.
Her hand tightened on the gun, but she couldn't quite do it. She glanced at Brianna, white-faced, then back, her hand trembling.
Shoot him, maman,
Germaine whispered, but the eagerness had gone from his face. He was pale too, and stood close to his mother.
You'll come along with me, darling, you and the lad.
I could feel the vibration through Bonnet's chest as he spoke and sense the half-smile on his face, though I couldn't see it.
The others can go.
Don't,
I said, trying to make Bree look at me. He won't let us go. You know he won't. He'll kill me and Massali, no matter what he says. The only thing to do is shoot him. If Massali can't do it, Bree, you'll have to.
That got her attention. Her eyes jerked to me, shocked. And Bonnet grunted, half in annoyance, half in amusement. Condemn her mother? She's not the girl to be doing such a thing, Mrs. Fraser.
Massali, he'll kill you and the babe with you, I said, straining every muscle to make her understand, to force her to fire. Germaine and Joan will die out here alone. What happens to me doesn't matter, believe me. For God's sake, shoot him now! She fired. There was a spark and a puff of white smoke, and Bonnet jerked. Then her hand sagged, the muzzle of the gun tilted down, and the wad and ball fell out on the sand with a tiny plop. Misfire. Massali moaned in horror, and Brianna moved like lightning, seizing the fallen bucket and hurling it at Bonnet's head. He yelped and threw himself aside, letting go his grip on me. The bucket struck me in the chest and I caught it, stupidly staring down into it. It was damp inside, with a scattering of the blue-white waxy berries stuck to the wood. Then Germaine and Jemmy were both crying. Joan was shrieking her head off in the wood, and I dropped the bucket and crawled madly for shelter behind a yorpen bush. Bonnet was back on his feet, face flushed, the knife in his hand. He was clearly furious, but made an effort to smile at Brianna.
"Ah, now, darling," he said, having to raise his voice to be heard above the racket. "It's only yourself and my son I'm wanting. I'll not be harming either of you.
"He's not your son," Rihanna said, low-voiced and vicious. "He'll never be yours."
He grunted contemptuously.
"Oh, aye. That's not how I heard it in that dungeon in Cross Creek, sweetheart. And now I see him."
He looked at Jemmy again, nodding slowly.
"He's mine, darling girl. He's the look of me. Haven't you, boyo?"
Jemmy buried his face in Brianna's skirts, howling. Bonnet sighed, shrugged, and gave up any pretense of cajolement.
"Come on, then," he said,
and started forward, obviously intending to scoop Jemmy up. Brianna's hand rose out of her skirts and aimed the pistol I had yanked out of his belt back at the place it had come from. Bonnet stopped in mid-step, mouth open. "What about it?" she whispered, and her eyes were fixed, unblinking. "Do you keep your powder dry, Stephen?" She braced the pistol with both hands, drew aim at his crotch, and fired. He was fast, I'd give him that. He hadn't time to turn and run, but was reaching to cover his threatened balls with both hands, even as she pulled the trigger. Blood exploded in a thick spray through his fingers, but I couldn't tell what she'd hit. He staggered back, clutching himself. He stared wildly round as though unable to believe it, then sank to one knee. I could hear him breathing hard and fast. We all stood paralysed, watching. One hand scrabbled at the sand, leaving bloody furrows. Then he rose, slowly, doubled over, the other hand pressed into his middle. His face was dead white, green eyes like dull water. He stumbled round, gasping, and made off like a bug that's been stepped on, leaking and hitching. There was a crashing noise as he blundered through the bushes, and then he was gone. Beyond a palmetto tree, I could see a line of pelicans flying, ungainly and impossibly graceful against the lowering sky. I was still crouched on the ground, chilled with shock. I felt something warm slide down my cheek and realised it was a raindrop. "Is he right?" Brianna was crouching beside me, helping me sit up. "Do you think he's right? Are they dead?" She was white to the lips, but not hysterical. She had Jemmy in the crook of her arm, clinging to her neck. "No," I said. Everything seemed remote, as though it were happening in slow motion. I stood up slowly, balancing precariously, as though not sure quite how to do it. "No," I said again, and felt no fear, no panic at the memory of what Bonnet had said. Nothing but a certainty in my chest like a small, comforting weight. "No, they're not." Jamie had told me this was not the day when he and I would part. Masali had vanished into the wood to retrieve Joni. Germaine was bent over the splotches of blood on the sand, studying them with fascination. It occurred to me dimly to wonder what type they were. But then I dismissed the thought from my mind. "He'll never be yours," she had said. "Let's go," I said, patting Jemmy gently. "I think we'll make do with unscented candles for now." Roger and Jamie appeared at dawn 2 days later, rousing everyone in the inn by pounding at the door and causing people in the neighbouring houses to throw open their shutters and put their night-capped heads out in alarm, owing to the resultant whooping and yelling. I was reasonably sure that Roger had a minor concussion, but he refused to be put to bed, though he did allow Bree to hold his head in her lap and make noises of shocked sympathy about the impressive lump on it, while Jamie gave us a terse account of the Battle of Wiley's Landing, and we gave a somewhat confused explanation of our adventures in the Myrtle Groves.
"So Bonnet's not dead?" Roger asked, opening one eye.
"Well, we don't know," I explained. "He got away, but I don't know how badly he was hurt. There wasn't a dreadful lot of blood, but if he was hit in the lower abdomen, that would be a terrible wound, and almost certainly fatal. Peritonitis is a very slow and nasty way to die."
"Good,"
Masali said vindictively.
good,
Germaine echoed, looking proudly up at her. Maman shot the bad man, grand-père, he told Jamie.
So did auntie. He was full of holes. There was blood everywhere. Holes,
Jamie said happily.
Holes, holes, lots of holes.
Well, maybe one hole, Brianna murmured. She didn't look up from the damp cloth with which she was gently sponging dried blood from Roger's scalp and hair.
Oh, aye. Well, if he only took off a finger or one of his balls, lass, he might survive,
Jamie observed, grinning at her.
Wouldn't improve his temper, though, I dinna suppose.
Fergus arrived on the noon packet boat, triumphantly bearing the registered, stamped and officially sealed deeds for the two land grants, thus putting the cocked hat on the day's rejoicing. The celebrations were limited, though, owing to the sobering knowledge that one rather major loose end remained. After a vigorous discussion, it was decided, meaning that Jamie made up his mind and pig-headedly refused to entertain dissenting views, that he and I would ride west at once to River Run. The young families would remain in Wilmington for a few days to complete business and to keep an ear out for any report of a wounded or dying man. They would then proceed back to Fraser's Ridge, keeping strictly clear of Cross Creek and River Run.
Lieutenant Wolfe canna be using threats to you or the lad to influence my aunt if you're nowhere near him,
Jamie pointed out to Brianna.
And as for you, Mohorshan, he said to Roger and Fergus, you canna be leaving the women and wains to look out for themselves. God kens who they might shoot next.
It was only as he closed the door on the resulting laughter that he turned to me, ran a fingertip over the scratch on my throat, and then pulled me so hard against him that I thought my ribs would break. I clung tight to him on the landing, not caring that I couldn't breathe or whether anyone might see, happy only to be touching him and to have him there to touch.
You did right, Claire,
he muttered at last, mouth against my hair.
But for God's sake, never do it again.
So it was that he and I left at dawn next day, alone. Chapter 104. Sly as Foxes. We arrived at River Run near sundown 3 days later, horses lathered and filthy, and ourselves in no better case. The place seemed peaceful enough, the last of the spring light glowing on green lawns and spotlighting the white marble statues and the stone of Hector's mausoleum among its dark yews. What do you think? I asked Jamie. We had reined up at the foot of the lawn, looking the situation over cautiously before approaching the house.
Well, no one's burned the place down, he replied, standing in his stirrups to survey the prospect, and I dinna see rivers of blood cascading down the front stair. Still.
He sat down, reached into his saddlebag, and withdrew a pistol, which he loaded and primed as a precaution. With this tucked into the waistband of his breeks, and concealed by the skirts of his coat, we rode slowly up the drive to the front door. By the time we had reached it, I knew something was wrong. There was a sinister air of stillness about the house, no sound of scurrying servants, no music from the parlour, no sense of supper being fetched in from the cookhouse. Most peculiar of all, Ulysses wasn't there to greet us. Our knocking went unanswered for several minutes, and when the door was at last opened, it was Phaedr, Jocasta's body servant, who appeared. She had looked dreadful when I had last seen her, nearly a year before, after her mother's death. She didn't look much better now. There were circles under her eyes, and her skin looked bruised and drawn, like a fruit beginning to go bad. When she saw us, though, her eyes lighted and her mouth relaxed in visible relief.
"Oh, Mr. Jamie," she cried, "I've been praying for someone to come help ever since yesterday. But I thought for sure it would be Mr. Farquhar, and then we may be in worse trouble. He's such a man for the law and all, even if he is your auntie's friend."
Jamie raised an eyebrow at this rather confused declaration, but nodded reassuringly and squeezed her hand.
"Aye, lass, I dinna believe I've been an answer to prayer before, but I've no objection. Is my aunt well?"
"Oh, yes, sir, she's well enough."
Withdrawing before we could ask further questions, she beckoned us toward the stair. Jocasta was in her boudoir, knitting. She raised her head at the sound of feet, alert, and before anyone could say anything, asked, "Jamie?" in a quavering voice, and stood up. Even at a distance, I could see that there were mistakes in the knitting, missed stitches and open runs, most unlike her usual fastidious needlework.
"Ah, it's me, Aunt, and Claire. What's amiss, then?"
Crossing the room in two strides, he reached her side and took her arm, patting her hand in reassurance. Her face underwent the same transformation of relief that we had seen in Phedre, and I thought she might give way at the knees. She stiffened her spine, though, and turned toward me.
"Claire, thank blessed bride you've come, though how... Well, never mind it for now. Will you come? Duncan's hurt."
Duncan lay in bed in the next room, inert under a stack of comforters. At first I was afraid he might be dead, but he stirred at once at the sound of Jocasta's voice.
"McDo,"
he said, puzzled. He poked his head up from the mound of covers, squinting to see in the dimness of the room.
"What in God's name brings you here?"
"Lieutenant Wolfe,"
Jamie said, a little caustically.
"Is the name perhaps familiar to you?"
"I might say so."
There was a slightly odd tone to Duncan's voice, but I paid it no mind, engaged in lighting candles and in excavating him sufficiently from the bedclothes to find out what the matter was. I was expecting to find a knife or gunshot wound. At first examination, there was nothing whatever of the sort visible, and it took a few moments' mental regrouping to discover that what he was suffering from was a broken leg. It was a simple fracture of the lower tibia, fortunately, and while undoubtedly painful, it seemed to be no great threat to his health. I sent Fed to find some splinting materials, while Jamie, informed that Duncan stood in no great danger, sat down to get to the bottom of things.
"Has he been here, Lieutenant Wolfe?" he asked.
"Aye, he has."
Again, a slight hesitation.
"Has he gone, then?"
"Oh, aye."
Duncan shuddered a little, involuntarily. "Am I hurting you?" I asked.
"Oh, no, Mrs. Clare," he assured me. "I was only... well..."
"You may as well tell me straight out, Duncan,"
Jamie said in a tone of mild exasperation.
"I think it'll no be a tale that improves wi' keeping, aye. And if it's the sort of tale I think, then I have a bitty story to tell to you as well."
Duncan eyed him narrowly, but then sighed, capitulating, and lay back on the pillow. The lieutenant had arrived at River Run 2 days before, but unlike his usual habit, hadn't come to the front door to be announced. Instead, he had left his horse hobbled in a field a mile from the house and approached stealthily on foot.
"We only realised as much because of finding the horse later, you see," Duncan explained to me as I bound his leg. "I didn't ken he was here at all until I went out to the necessary after supper and he leapt at me out of the dark. I nearly died of fright, and then I near died of being shot, for he fired at me. And if I'd had an arm on that side, I dare say he would have struck it. Only I hadn't got one, so he didn't."
In spite of his disability, Duncan had fought back ferociously, butting the lieutenant in the face, charging him and knocking him backward.
"He staggered and tripped himself on the brick walk and fell backward so as he hit his head a dreadful smack it."
He shuddered again at memory of the sound.
"Like a melon hit wi' an axe it was."
"Oh, aye. So was he killed at once, then?"
Jamie asked, interested.
"Well, no."
Duncan had grown easier in his manner telling the tale, but now began to look uneasy again.
"Now see here, McDo. Here's the pinch of the matter. For I'd gone staggering too when I knocked him out, and I stepped into the stone channel from the necessary and snapped my leg. And there I lay groaning by the walk. Ulysses heard me calling at last and came down and Joe after him."
Duncan had told Jocasta what had happened, as Ulysses had gone to fetch a couple of grooms to help carry Duncan into the house. And then, between the pain of his broken leg and his habit of leaving difficulties to the butler to be resolved, had likewise left the lieutenant.
"That was my fault, McDo, and I ken it well," he said.
his face drawn and pale.
I ought to have given orders of some kind, though in fact I canna think even now what I ought to have said, and I've had time and plenty enough to think.
The rest of the story, pried out of him with reluctance, was that Jocasta and Ulysses had evidently conferred on the matter, and concluded that the lieutenant had gone beyond being a nuisance, and become an outright threat. And that being so...
"Ulysses killed him," Duncan said boldly,
then stopped as though appalled afresh. He swallowed, looking deeply unhappy.
"Joe says as how she ordered him to do it. And Christ knows, MacDoo, she might have done so. She's no the woman to be trifled with, let alone to have her servants murdered, herself threatened, and her husband set upon."
I gathered from his hesitance, though, that some small doubt about Jocasta's part in this still lingered in his mind. Jamie had grasped the main point troubling him, though.
"Christ," he said, "the man Ulysses will be hanged on this spot, or worse if anyone hears of it, whether my aunt ordered it or no."
Duncan looked a little calmer now that the truth was out. He nodded.
"Aye, that's it," he agreed. "I canna let him go to the gallows. But what am I to do about the lieutenant? There's the navy to be considered, to say nothing of sheriffs and magistrates."
That was a definite point. A good deal of the prosperity of River Run depended upon its naval contracts for timber and tar. Lieutenant Wolfe had, in fact, been the naval liaison responsible for such contracts. I could see that His Majesty's Navy might just possibly be inclined to look squiggle-eyed at a proprietor who had killed his local naval representative, no matter what the excuse. I imagined that the law, in the person of sheriff and magistrates, might take a more lenient view of the situation, save for the person of the perpetrator. A slave who shed the blood of a white person was automatically condemned, regardless of provocation. It would make no difference what had happened, even with a dozen witnesses to testify to Wolfe's attack on Duncan. Ulysses would be doomed. If anyone found out about it. I began to understand the air of desperation that hung over River Run. The other slaves were well aware of what might happen. Jamie rubbed a knuckle over his chin.
"Ah, just how did... I mean, would it not be possible to say you'd done it yourself, Duncan? It was self-defence, after all. And I've evidence that the man did come in order to murder you, with the notion of marrying my aunt, then, by force, or at least holding her hostage so she might be threatened into telling about the gold."
"Gold?" Duncan looked blank.
"But there isn't any gold here. I thought we'd got that straight last year."
"The lieutenant and his associates thought there was," I told him. "But Jamie can tell you all about that in a bit. What did happen to the lieutenant exactly?"
"Ulysses cut his throat," Duncan said,
and swallowed, Adam's apple bobbing in his own throat.
"I should be pleased enough to say I'd done it, aye, only..."
Beyond the simple difficulty of cutting someone's throat with only one hand, it was evidently all too apparent that the lieutenant's throat had been cut by a left-handed person, and Duncan, of course, lacked a left hand altogether. I happen to know that Jocasta Cameron, like her nephew, was left-handed, but it seemed more tactful not to mention that at the moment. I glanced at Jamie, who raised both brows at me.
"Would she?"
I asked silently.
"A Mackenzie of Leoch,"
his cynical look said back.
"Where is Ulysses?"
I asked.
"In the stable, most like, if he hasn't already headed west."
Knowing that if anyone learned the truth of the lieutenant's death, Ulysses would be condemned at once, Jocasta had sent her butler to saddle a horse, with instructions to flee into the mountain should anyone come. Jamie drew a deep breath and rubbed a hand over his head, thinking.
"Well, then, I should say the best thing, perhaps, is for the lieutenant to disappear. Where have you put him for the moment, Duncan?"
A muscle near Duncan's mouth twitched in an uneasy attempt at a smile.
"I believe he's in the barbecue pit, MacDoo, covered over with burlap and piled with hickory wood, disguised as a pork carcass."
Jamie's brows went up again, but he merely nodded.
"Aye, then,
Leave it to me, Duncan.
I left instructions for Duncan to be given honeyed water and tea brewed with boneset and cherry bark, and went outside with Jamie to contemplate methods of disappearance. The simplest thing would be just to bury him somewhere, I suppose, I said.
Mm-hmm,
Jamie said. He lifted the pine torch he was carrying, frowning thoughtfully at the humped mound of burlap in the pit. I hadn't liked the lieutenant in the least, but it looked rather pitiful.
Maybe. I'm thinking, though, the slaves all ken what's happened. If we bury him on the place, they'll ken that too. They wouldn't tell anyone, of course, but he'll haunt the place, aye?
A shiver ran up my spine, engendered as much by the matter-of-factness of his tone as by his words, and I pulled my shawl closer round me. Haunt the place?
Aye, of course. A murder victim, done to death here and hidden, unavenged.
You mean, really haunt the place? I asked carefully. Or do you only mean the slaves would think so? He shrugged, twitching his shoulders uneasily.
I dinna think it matters so much, does it? They'll avoid the spot where he's buried. One of the women will see the ghost at night, rumours will get round as they do, and next thing, a slave at Green River will see something. Someone in Farquhar's family will hear of it, and before you know it, someone will be over here asking questions. Given that the Navy is like to be looking for the lieutenant before too long anyway, what do you say to weighting the body and putting it in the river? That's what he had in mind for Duncan, after all.
Not a bad notion, I said, considering it. But he meant Duncan to be found. There's a lot of boat traffic on the river, and it isn't very deep up this far. Even if we weighted the body well, it's possible it would rise or someone snag it with a pole. Would it matter if someone found it, though, do you think? The body wouldn't be connected with River Run. He nodded slowly, moving the torch aside to keep the sparks from showering over his sleeve. There was a light wind, and the elms near the barbecue pit whispered restlessly overhead.
Aye, that's so. Only if someone does find him, there'll be an inquiry. The Navy will send someone to try to find out the truth of the matter, and they'll come here asking questions. What do you think will happen if they were to badger the slaves, asking had they seen the lieutenant and so on?
Yes. Given the slaves' present acute state of nerves, I imagined that any inquiry would send one or more of them into a state of panic, in which anything might be blurted out. Jamie was standing quite still, staring at the burlap-draped shape with an expression of deep abstraction. I drew a deep breath, caught a faint scent of decaying blood, and let it out again quick. I suppose we could burn him, I said, and swallowed a sudden taste of bile. He is already in the pit, after all.
That's a thought, Jamie said,
and one corner of his mouth quirked in a faint smile.
But I think of a better one, Sassenach.
He turned to look thoughtfully at the house. A few windows were dimly alight, but everyone was inside, cowering.
Come on, then,
he said with sudden decision.
There'll be a sledgehammer in the stable, I expect.
The front of the mausoleum was covered by an ornamental grille of black wrought iron with an enormous lock, its metal decorated by 16-petaled Jacobite roses. I had always considered this to be merely one of Jocasta Cameron's affectations, since I doubted that grave robbers were a great threat in such a rural setting. The hinges scarcely creaked when Jamie unlocked the grille and swung it open. Like everything else at River Run, it was maintained in impeccable condition. "You really think this is better than burying or burning him?" I asked. There was no one nearby, but I spoke in a near whisper.
"Why, old Hector will take care of him and prevent him doing harm," Jamie replied matter-of-factly. "And it's blessed ground, in a manner of speaking. No, a matter of leaving his soul to wander about, making trouble, aye?"
I nodded, a little uncertainly. He was probably right. In terms of belief, Jamie understood the slaves much better than I did. For that matter, I wasn't sure whether he was speaking only of what the psychological effect on them might be,
or whether he was himself convinced that Hector Cameron ought to be capable of dealing with this ex post facto threat to his wife and plantation. I lifted the torch so Jamie could see what he was doing and set my teeth in my lower lip. He had wrapped the sledgehammer in rags so as not to chip the marble blocks. The small blocks of the front wall inside the grill had been expertly cut to fit and lightly mortared in place. The first blow knocked two of the blocks a few inches out of place. A few more blows, and a dark space showed where the blocks had given way enough to show the blackness inside the mausoleum. Jamie stopped to wipe sweat from his forehead and muttered something under his breath. "What did you say?"
"I said it stinks," he replied,
sounding puzzled. "This is surprising, is it?" I asked, a little testily. "How long has Hector Cameron been dead? 4 years?"
"Well, aye, but it's new."
"What are you doing?" Jocasta Cameron's voice rang out behind me, sharp with agitation, and I jumped, dropping the torch. It flickered, but didn't go out, and I snatched it up again, waving it to encourage the flame. The flame rose and steadied, shedding a ruddy glow on Jocasta, who stood on the path behind us, ghostly in her white nightgown. Phaedre huddled behind her mistress, no more of her face visible than the brief shine of eyes in the darkness. The eyes looked scared, flicking from Jamie and me to the dark hole in the façade of the mausoleum.
"What am I doing? Disposing of Lieutenant Wolfe, what else?"
Jamie, who had been as startled as I had by his aunt's sudden appearance, sounded a little cross.
"Leave it to me, aunt. You needn't concern yourself."
"You are not... No, you mustn't open Hector's tomb."
Jocasta's long nose twitched, obviously picking up the scent of decay, which was faint but distinct.
"Dinna fash yourself, aunt," Jamie said. "Go back to the house. I'll manage. It will all be well."
She ignored his soothing words, advancing blindly over the walk, hands groping in the empty air.
"No, Jamie, you mustn't. Close it up again. Close it, for God's sake."
The panic in her voice was unmistakable, and I saw Jamie frown in confusion. He looked uncertainly from his aunt to the hole in the mausoleum. The wind had dropped, but now rose in a small gust, wafting a much stronger scent of death around us. Jamie's face changed, and ignoring his aunt's cries of protest, he knocked loose more blocks with several quick blows of the padded hammer.
"Bring the torch, Sassenach," he said, setting down the hammer.
And with a sense of creeping horror, I did so. We stood shoulder to shoulder, peering through the narrow gap in the blocks. Two coffins of polished wood stood inside, each on a pedestal of marble, and on the floor between them...
"Who is he, aunt?"
Jamie's voice was quiet as he turned to speak to her. She stood as if paralysed, the muslin of her gown flapping round her legs in the wind, pulling strands of white hair from beneath her cap. Her face was frozen, but the blind eyes darted to and fro, seeking an impossible escape. Jamie stepped forward and grabbed her fiercely by the arm, making her start from her frozen trance.
"Quahoun," he growled. "Who is he? Who?"
Her mouth worked, trying to form words. She stopped, swallowed, tried again, eyes still flickering to and fro over his shoulder, looking at God knew what. Had she still been able to see when they put him in there, I wondered? Did she see it now, in memory?
His name was Rawlings," she said faintly.
And something inside my chest fell like an iron weight. I must have moved or made some sound, for Jamie's eyes went to me. He reached out a hand for mine and held on tightly, though his eyes went back to Jocasta.
"How?"
he asked, calmly, but with a tone that warned that he would brook no evasion. She closed her eyes then and sighed, broad shoulders slumping suddenly.
"Hector killed him," she said.
"Oh, aye."
Jamie cast a cynical glance at the coffins inside the mausoleum,
and the huddled mass that lay on the floor between them.
A good trick, that. I hadn't realised my uncle was so capable.
Before?
Her eyes opened again, but she spoke dully, as though nothing mattered any longer.
He was a doctor, Rawlings. He'd come to look at my eyes once before. When Hector took ill, he called the man back. I canna say quite what happened, but Hector caught him nosing round where he should not, and smashed his head in. He was a hot-tempered man, Hector.
I should see so,
Jamie said, with another glance at the body of Dr. Rawlings.
How did he get in here?
He hid the corpse, meaning to carry it off and leave it in the wood. But then Hector got worse and couldn't leave his bed. Within a day he was dead too, and so...
She lifted a long white hand, gesturing toward the draught of dank chill that floated from the open tomb.
Great minds think alike, I murmured.
And Jamie gave me a dirty look, letting go of my hand. He stood contemplating the stillness inside the violated mausoleum, thick brows drawn down in a frown of concentration.
Oh, aye,
he said again.
Whose is the second coffin?
Mine.
Jocasta was recovering her nerve, her shoulders straightened and her chin lifted. Jamie made a small puffing noise and glanced at me. I could believe that Jocasta would callously leave a dead man to lie exposed rather than put him in her own pristine coffin. And yet, to do so drastically increased the odds of discovery, slim as those might be. No one would have opened Jocasta's coffin until it was time to receive her own body. Dr. Rawlings' corpse could have lain there in complete safety, even were the mausoleum to be opened for some reason. Jocasta Cameron was selfish, but by no means stupid.
"Put Wolf in, then, if you must," she said. "He can lie on the floor with the other one."
"Why not put him in your coffin, aunt?"
Jamie asked, and I saw that he was looking at her intently.
"No."
She'd begun to turn away, but at this whipped back, her blind face fierce in the torchlight.
"He is dung. Let him lie and rot in the open."
Jamie narrowed his eyes at her response, but didn't reply. Instead, he turned to the tomb and began to shift the loosened blocks.
"What are you doing?"
Jocasta could hear the grating noise of the shifting marble and became agitated anew. She turned round on the walk, but became disoriented, staring off toward the river. I realised that she must now be completely blind, unable even to see the light from the torch. I had no attention to pay her just then, though. Jamie wedged himself through the gap in the blocks and stepped inside.
"Light me, Sassenach,"
he said softly, and his voice echoed slightly in the small stone chamber. Breathing very shallowly, I followed him. Phaedra had begun to moan in the darkness outside. She sounded like the banshee that howls for approaching death. But this death had come long since. The coffins were equipped with brass plates, gone slightly green with damp, but still easily readable. Hector Alexander Robert Cameron read one, and Jocasta Isabel Mackenzie Cameron the other. Without hesitation, Jamie seized the edges of the lid of Jocasta's coffin and pulled up. It wasn't nailed. The lid was heavy, but shifted at once.
"Oh,"
Jamie said softly, looking down.
This ends Disc 44. The Fiery Cross, Disc 45.
Gold will never tarnish, no matter how damp or dank its surroundings. It will lie at the bottom of the sea for centuries, to emerge one day in some random fisherman's net, bright as the day it was smelted. It glimmers from a rocky matrix, a siren's song that has called to men for thousands of years. The ingots lay in a shallow layer over the bottom of the coffin, enough to fill two small chests, each chest heavy enough to require two men, or a man and a strong woman, to carry it. Each ingot stamped with a fleur-de-lis. 1/3 of the Frenchman's gold. I blinked at the shimmer and looked aside, my eyes blurring with fractured light. It was dark on the floor, but I could still make out the huddled form against the pale marble.
Nosing where he should not.
And what had he seen, Daniel Rawlings, that had made him draw the fleur-de-lis in the margin of his casebook with that discreet notation, Aurum? Hector Cameron was still alive then. The mausoleum had not yet been sealed. Perhaps when Dr. Rawlings rose to follow his wandering patient, Hector had led him here unwitting, going down in the night to view his hoard.
Perhaps.
Neither Hector Cameron nor Daniel Rawlings could say, now, how it had been, or what had happened. I felt a thickening in my throat for the man whose bones lay now at my feet, the friend and colleague whose instruments I had inherited, whose shade had stood at my elbow, lending me both courage and comfort when I laid hands on the sick and sought to heal them.
Such a waste, I said softly, looking down.
Jamie lowered the coffin lid gently, as though the coffin held an occupant whose rest had been disturbed.
Outside, Jocasta stood still on the path. She had an arm round Phaedra, who had stopped whimpering, but it wasn't clear which of them was supporting the other.
Jocasta must know now from the noise where we were, but she faced the river still, eyes fixed, unblinking in the torchlight. I cleared my throat, hugging the shawl tighter with my free hand.
"What shall we do, then?" I asked Jamie.
He turned and looked back into the tomb for a moment, then shrugged a little.
"We'll leave the lieutenant to Hector, as we planned.
As for the doctor..."
He drew breath slowly, troubled gaze fixed on the slender bones that lay in a graceful fan, pale and still in the light. A surgeon's hand. Once.
"I think," he said, "we will take him home with us, to the ridge. Let him lie among friends."
He brushed past the two women without acknowledgement or pardon, and went to fetch Lieutenant Wolfe. Chapter 105. A Thrush's Dream. Fraser's Ridge, May 1772. The night air was cool and fresh. So early in the year, the bloodthirsty flies and mosquitoes hadn't started yet. Only random moths came in through the open window now and then to flutter round the smoored hearth like bits of burning paper, brushing past their outflung limbs in brief caress. She lay as she had fallen, half on top of him, heart thumping loud and slow in her ears. From here she could see out through the window, the jagged black line of trees on the far side of the dooryard, and beyond them a section of sky lit with stars, so near and bright that it should be possible to step out among them and walk from one to another, higher and higher, to the hook of the crescent moon.
"You're no mad at me," he whispered.
He spoke more easily now, but lying with her ear on his chest, she could hear the faint catch in his voice, the point where he forced air hard through his scarred throat to form the words.
"No."
His hand was on her hair, stroking.
"I didn't ever tell you not to read it."
His fingers touched her shoulder lightly, and her toes curled with pleasure at the feeling.
Did she mind?
No. She supposed she ought to feel exposed in some way, the privacy of her thoughts and dreams laid bare to him. But she trusted him with them. He would never use those things against her.
Besides, once set down on paper, the dreams became a separate thing from her, herself.
Much like the drawing she had made, a reflection of one facet of her mind, a brief glimpse of something once seen, once thought, once felt, but not the same thing as the mind or heart that made them.
Not quite.
"Fair's fair, though."
Her chin rested in the hollow of his shoulder.
He smelled good, bitter and musky with the scent of satisfied desire.
"Tell me one of your dreams, then."
A laugh vibrated through his chest, nearly soundless, but she felt it.
"Only one?"
"Yes, but it has to be an important one.
not the flying ones, or the ones where you're being chased by a monster, or the ones where you go to school without your clothes on. Not the ones that everybody has. One that only you have. One of her hands was on his chest, scratching